Hi, everybody. My name is Jeffrey, and I am a real alcoholic. And it's good to be here. I've had months to think about this, and luckily I don't remember things, so I forgot about it until about a week ago, and then I'm like, oh, no, I've got to do this. But it's an honor. And when I speak, I get in touch with what it was really like and what happened and what I'm like today. And my life today is completely different than the guy that showed up here. I'd like to start off by sharing a little story that most of my friends hate, but I do it anyway because it kind of gets me a little bit centered. The most important date I have is the date that I stopped drinking, or the date that I took my last drink. I'm also fortunate to know the date I took my first drink, which most people don't. My first drink was taken on December 14th, 1955. And most people look and they go, well, how's that possible? And the answer to that is I grew up in the Jewish religion, and when you're a week old, they do a ceremony, which is called a bris, and it's a circumcision, and they give you wine to keep you from crying. So, well, you would cry too. So I don't remember much about that first drink, but I know I was probably grateful to have it at the time. So the more important date is the date I took my last drink, which was June 25th, 1984. So I just celebrated 26 years of sobriety this past June. And there's a lot that happened between the first date and the last date, and a lot that's happened from the date I stopped until today. So I'll go back to where it started. I grew up in Washington, D.C., or the suburbs of D.C. I'm the youngest of three kids. I grew up in a middle-class family. I grew up in the suburbs. I never had to do without. I never knew what it was like to not have, or to be hungry, or to not have shoes, or, you know, I was always provided for. I was fortunate in the fact that I can remember the neighborhood I grew up, and I can still visualize, and I can still picture the street, and I know the names of every household on that street, and I know the names of the kids that lived in each of those households, and they all had two, three, four kids, and at the end of the street was a junior high school, and it had a big field, and it had tennis courts and baseball field and basketball. And, you know, it was back then you could do anything. You could ride your bike. You know, people weren't afraid of their kids getting kidnapped or things happening, you know. And so we were free to just play in the neighborhood, you know. And I used to spend time with the neighbors and the neighbors' kids. And it was also very unique because my mom has a sister, and her sister lived three houses away from us and their family. They have three kids. We have three kids. All the kids are the same exact ages. So it was like having one big family, and we would go back and forth to each other's houses, and we would have dinners at each other's houses. And it was kind of like having two sets of parents almost, which is very important in my life today. So, you know, growing up, I don't have an excuse. You know, I hear people share from the podium that they come from a broken home. I didn't come from a broken home. I hear people share from the podium that they come from a long line of alcoholics. I don't think there's any alcoholism that we're aware of in my family. So, you know, once again, it made me different. It made me somewhat of a trendsetter. You know, and I was always different. I never quite fit in. I always had to be my own unique person, even when it got me in trouble. You know, I've never been kind of a corporate guy that followed directions. And that came even in recovery. I found it hard to follow directions in the beginning. So life kind of went on. You know, I grew up in just kind of a normal setting, but for some reason I felt like I never fit in, and for some reason I always felt a little bit different, and for some reason I always felt that my skin really didn't quite fit. And I remember when I was about 7 or 8 years old, my parents sent me away to summer camp. Now, I have a older brother, older sister. They had been going away to summer camp, and now it was my turn to go with them, and I didn't want to go. And I remember they made me go, and I don't know why I didn't want to go. I don't know what my fear was. But the solution to that was to eat a bottle of aspirin, thinking that I would get sick enough and I wouldn't go. The fact is, I never told anybody that I did that, and I ended up going anyway, and it didn't help my stomach any. I can tell you that. So you know things. You know, I started keeping secrets, and I started having issues, and I started not wanting to do things, and as I grew older, I always had friends. I always had people around, and if I didn't, I had my cousin that was my identical age, and Ronnie and I were like 3 months apart, and we were like brothers growing up, and we experimented, and we did a lot of things together, and we used to play together, and he was the first person I got high with. So, you know, as life progressed, I'll just move forward that I didn't really have anything pressing going on in my life. You know, I was going to school, I was getting good grades, and one of those students that I was fortunate in the fact if I hear something once, I could retain it and I could recite it. And so I didn't have to work very hard to achieve good grades in school. I was able to get decent grades without really putting much effort out. My life started to really change the summer between junior high school and high school. And I started hanging around with different kids. And I remember back then, it seemed like every weekend, families would go away. Somebody's parents would leave town. And whosever parents were away, that's where the party was. And I remember this very first weekend, my friend Rick and his parents left town. And I had known his family for years, and our moms were friends. And his parents were out of town. And he said, you know, everybody's coming to my house. Come over to the house. We're having a party. And I went to the house, and I noticed that they kept going out back, and I didn't know what they were doing out there. And finally, they said, come on, and, you know, and they were smoking pot. And I had never been around it. And they taught me how to do it and taught me how to hold it in. And I had a lot of fear about doing that. And I remember I thought it didn't do anything to me, but I remember spending pretty much the rest of the night staring in the refrigerator. And the next night, I drank a bottle of Southern Comfort, and I remember getting so sick that it was the last time I drank Southern Comfort. And I remember I was in the fall, and back east, and all the leaves would come down in the autumn, and there were these huge piles of leaves, and I was in the gutter, flying around in the leaves, saying, you know, look, I'm in the gutter. And I didn't know that's where I would end up. And, you know, so the point of the story is it was just fun. You know, it was just a kid having fun doing stupid things. You know, that same night I almost choked to death on a peanut butter sandwich, and I fell down the flight of steps with this girl, just crazy, 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 crazy stuff. And I was never afraid to do anything. I don't know what it was, but I from the first time I took that drink, the drink took me, because there was a certain amount of excitement. I think part of me, there was a certain amount of rebel in me. And I liked doing things that I wasn't supposed to do just for the challenge of doing it. And I could do those things without getting caught, because on the outside, I looked like a good kid. And I, you know, showed up where I was supposed to show up, and I was home when I was supposed to be home. And yet I started kind of leading this double life, and I was getting more and more into experimenting. And so as I got older and in high school, now you have to remember it's the early 70s, and the drugs were a big part of my story, and I washed them all down with a lot of alcohol. And in the big book, it talks about, in Bill's story, he talks about mixing sedatives with alcohol, and he talks about the poison behind the medicine cabinet. And in There Is a Solution, it talks about the poison, and it talks about mixing sedatives with alcohol. And so the big book does throughout talk about drugs and alcohol. My primary drug was Yours and More. And whatever I could get and whatever I could do, I just liked the experimentation. I liked the thrill of doing things that I wasn't supposed to do. And so here I am in high school, and I'm a teenager now, and I still don't really have much stress in my life. I'm living at home. My brother and sister are now away at college, so I'm the only kid at home. And there was an event that happened that altered the destiny of my life. You know, there's certain things that happen in life that sometimes alter the outcome. And I believe for me, this was one of those events that changed the destiny of my life. And I was 16 years old, and my dad had his own business, and he would work really hard, and he worked 6 days a week, and he would get up early, and he would go to work, and we would have to wait until he came home to eat dinner as a family, and whatever time that was that he would come home, that's when dinner was, and that was really important to my mom, that the family had dinner together as a family unit. And we had balanced meals, and always had to have, a balanced meal. And, you know, a lot of the things that I thought were stupid, I realize are important today. But so I'm 16 years old, and my dad, who I couldn't remember ever being sick a day in his life, didn't feel well. And they went to the doctor, and the doctor checked him into the hospital, and they were going to do an exploratory surgery, and they found out that he had pancreatic cancer. And this is in the early 70s, and he, they decided to do, and at the time it was experimental, and it became a very common, or I don't know about common, but a very well-known surgery called the Whiffle, named after the doctor that first performed it. And they removed half his stomach, half his liver, half his pancreas, basically half his organs. And it was a 12-hour surgery, and it's a major, major surgery. And in today's world, they typically tell people don't do it because the recovery is so difficult from something like that. But he was basically a strong guy and had never been sick, and they performed the surgery. And the thing that was really strange about it is my mom told me what was going on. I never talked to my dad about it ever, ever, ever. And we never used the word cancer. We never talked about it. And he almost died from the surgery, and the first few days were really touch and go. And he survived, and he started to do really better. And the staff would say, "Here's our prize patient." And within a year, he was playing golf again. He loved to play golf, and he was back at work. And I thought, you know, life is okay. And things went well for about a year, and then the cancer came back. And again, we never talked about it. And he was just this jaundiced yellow color, and he just told people he had hepatitis. And we all knew that he was going to die. I remember my mom coming home, and he'd gone back in the hospital, and she said, "Your dad's not going to get better." And that altered my life, because what had been just fun for me up to that point of partying, I started to use and to drink as an escape to not feel feelings. And I never shared with my friends what was going on at home. You know, we used to go to all the friends' houses and you know, party at the different houses. But I never had people come to my house, and I never told them why. And I don't know why, but I was ashamed of it. And I was ashamed that he looked so bad, and I was ashamed that he was sick. And I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to talk about it. I didn't know how to share feelings. I didn't know how to share my emotions. And I just went into this mode of drinking to forget and to get as obliterated as I could. And what happens when you do that is you wake up in the morning and the problem's still there, and then you have other problems associated. So as he got sicker and as things progressed, my using and my drinking progressed. And I don't really use that as an excuse, but that's the reality of what happened for me. And I was still having fun with friends, and I was still doing things, but it had changed me. And now I'm in my first semester of college, and my dad passes away. And I was really, really upset. And that I had never been to a funeral before. The first funeral I ever went to was his. And so I remember for the first time. Now, I had been partying for a number of years, and I call it partying because that's really what it was. I went to a party, and I just stayed at it for 15 years. And And I remember the night that my dad had passed away, my cousin Ron came over with his friends, and it was very strange because one of our best friends, Rick, his mom had passed away the day before. It was their 25th wedding anniversary, and they had a big anniversary party, and his mom and dad his mom was dancing with her boss, and she had a major heart attack and died on the dance floor at her 25th wedding anniversary. So my friend Rick, who had just lost his mom, comes to the house, and I'm there with my brother and sister and my family and my cousins, and my cousin Ron says, let's just go out and get drunk and forget about it. And for some reason, it was the first time that I had ever felt like maybe Dad wouldn't appreciate that. Maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe not tonight. And I went anyway. And I remember feeling it was the first time I ever had guilt about using or drinking. And so we went out and we got drunk and we drove around and came back home. And just, you know, that was the way that I dealt with feelings. And the morning of the funeral, my mom gave me a pill. And I said, what's that? And she goes, a Valium to calm you down. And I had never been to a funeral. And the whole thing's kind of a dream. What I remember about that is I didn't cry ever in front of family or friends, but I cried a whole lot on my own and in my room or out of the house. And I don't know why I had such a hard time. I started to really shut down. I had a very difficult time expressing myself and my feelings. And so my drinking continued. Now I'm in college, and my dad had this business. He had a junk business in Washington, D.C. And my mom said to my brother and myself, it was your dad's business. It's basically bankrupt. He had been sick for a long time. The guys that were managing it and running it basically had run it into the ground and stolen whatever else was there. And she said, it's your dad's. If you want it, I'll lend you some money. You can give it a try. If not, stay in school, get an education, get a degree, and do something else. And I always knew that I wanted to be in business, so I said, well, we'll try. And I didn't know how to open. I didn't know how to close. I didn't know how to run the place. I didn't know who we bought from, who we sold to. And we learned. We learned from the bottom up. And within a couple of years, we had become very successful. And within a couple of years after that, we had closed the place that my dad had for years and years and opened this big plant. And today they call them recycling centers. But it was really a junk business and scrap metal and paper. And we became the largest junk business on the East Coast, and we had train tracks and boxcars, and we would ship all over the world. And what happened with that is now I have some means, I have some assets, I have a little bit of money, and I really got into expensive whiskeys and drinking fine drinks and really good pot and really good cocaine. And I thought it was really cool because I would get high with some really class people. You know, I was there were a lot of doctors and attorneys that did that stuff, you know, and they actually have meetings for those guys here. But, you know, so I was thinking, how bad can it be if these guys are professional and they're doing the same thing? But what happened was somewhere along the line, and I can't tell you exactly when that specifically had happened, but I crossed this invisible line. And you hear about it in these rooms that once you're a pickle, you can never be a cucumber again. And I was becoming a pickle. And I was using large amounts of drugs, and I was drinking large amounts of alcohol. And I started to have consequences. I started to get in trouble. I started to not want to see clients when I was at work. I would lock myself in the office and tell the secretary that I was busy and I was doing coke on the desk. And I had this thing with my brother, because we really didn't get along, that I would work half a day and then he would come in and work the other half, and we would switch back and forth so we didn't have to work together. And that's not a real good way to run a business. And because he wanted to run it his way and I wanted to run it my way, and we could never agree, so we just said, you run it your way when you're here and I'll run it my way when I'm here. And the employees really didn't know what to think. I mean, it was a mess. And needless to say, that successful business started becoming less successful over time. And my habit became more successful with time. And I started to have little things happen, like getting arrested for driving under the influence. And my first DWI or DUI at the time was coming back from a wedding. And I drove with a group of friends, and it was a really good friend, close friend's wedding. And we drove from Washington, D.C. to the Baltimore area for this wedding. And all my friends were getting hotel rooms and staying because they knew they were going to be drinking. And I said, I can drive back. And the arrest report says I was taking all three lanes. And it was pouring down rain, and I just really couldn't see. And the wipers were going as fast as they could. And I got lost, and I was driving too fast. And I ended up getting arrested, and I was thrown in Baltimore County Jail, which was not a fun place. And somehow I got in touch with one of my friends and said, you guys have to pick me up. And they left the car on the side of the road. And I couldn't understand why my friends didn't come till like the middle of the next day. You know, they didn't understand how important I was, that I wanted to get out early in the morning. And they were going to release me, but I needed somebody to post bail. And it wasn't a big bail. It was the first time I'd ever been in trouble. The other problem that I had is when I drank, I liked to do other things. So I always had other things with me. And so it was a possession charge on top of the DUI. I need to start getting sober. So fast forward a couple more DUIs, a couple more times in jail, a couple more incidents with the police, and my using and drinking escalating to a point where I was doing it on a daily basis. And finally what happened is I ended up in treatment. I ended up in treatment in 1982, October 17th, 1982, and I had gotten arrested again. And I said, I will go to treatment. Well, actually, the judge said, you have a choice. You can either go to jail or you can go into an inpatient treatment facility. And I thought about it for a while, and I said, well, I think I'll try the treatment. And I went on this tour of treatment centers thinking that I needed to find a treatment center that would fit my needs. And I remember going home and I was living on my own by then. And I went home and told my mom that I thought maybe I should look at treatment centers in Europe or something. And she just looked at me and shook her head and said, you know, you're really crazy. You know, she used to tell me things like, if these guys in white jackets come to the house and come to help you, don't be afraid of them. They're not going to hurt you. One night I called her. I was watching, I don't know if you guys know this movie, Three Faces of Eve. And I was really, 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 really messed up. And I called my mom drunk after watching this movie. And I said, I know what's wrong with me now. I just watched this movie, Three Faces of Eve, and it's about multi-personalities. And she was like, Jeffrey, come home now. And then I realized what I was saying, and I said, I'm just kidding, Mom. You know, we put our families through a lot. I put my family through a lot, and they stuck by me, but... But, you know, they wanted to help me. And I remember my mom going to court. And it was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life because she was arguing with my attorney that I needed to go to jail. And she was kind of yelling at him that I needed to go to jail because she thought if I went to jail, I couldn't drink and I would be safe and that I needed help. And she didn't know about treatment or anything. She just said he needs to go away. And the attorney's arguing that it's my job to keep him out of jail, and he's paid me. And then finally, the judge said, could you guys take that outside, please? You know, and I was, like, humiliated. So, anyhow, I went to treatment, and I went to treatment because I wanted to stay out of jail. I went to treatment because it was the softer, easier way. And I ended up at this place called Springwood Psychiatric Institute. And it was a really nice name, and it was a really pretty place. I did go on a tour of some treatment centers, and one of them was this place, Shepherd Pratt in Baltimore. And Shepherd Pratt's been around for years and years as part of Johns Hopkins University. And you had to pay to go through this interview. And I went through this intake interview, and I had to pay this woman to listen to me for 45 minutes. And it was the first time I'd been even somewhat honest with anybody about my using and drinking. And she listened, and I, you know, told her this whole story. Most of it was true. You know, I didn't tell her really the depth of what I was doing. And at the end of it, I said, "Well, when do I check in?" And she goes, "You don't." And I looked at her and said, "What do you mean I don't?" And she said, "You don't want it bad enough. When you're in a gutter and you're crying out for help, come back and see me, and we'll let you in." And that was the first person in my life to ever see right through me. So I ended up at this other place, Springwood Psychiatric Institute. And the first person I walk into the place, and I brought, and this is 1982. I had like this Texas Instrument computer, and I brought a tennis racket, and I had luggage, and I had all these bags of stuff, and they're like, "Where do you think you're going?" And I had this boom box and all my music, and the first person I walk into is this guy, Craig. And Craig was the brother of this girl that I used to date, Terry. And I said, "Craig, hey." And he goes, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm just here for a little rest and relaxation." And I said, "What are you doing here?" And he goes, "I'm a fucking junkie. That's what I'm doing here." And I was like, "Wow, you know, you really need to be here." So I stayed in this place, and once a week they would do this thing called Star Wars. And Star Wars was in the gymnasium. They would put the families on one side and the patients on the other, and you could say anything that you ever wanted to say to them in front of everybody else. And it was really Star Wars. There was stuff flying back and forth. So I remember my mom coming the day of Star Wars, and she was all excited because I had been there 28 days, and I was cured, and I was well. And she went up to the director's office, and she was, you know, dressed nicely, and she was smiling, and she was really happy that, you know, finally her son is back, and he's gone through this treatment, and everything's fixed. And 5 minutes later, she comes out of the director's office just crying, and I'm like, "What did I do now?" And they said, "Well, you might as well go home because you haven't done a darn thing since you've been here." And so that night at Star Wars, in front of everybody, I said, "This is what happened. They think I haven't done anything. And you guys know how much work I've done. You can tell my mom and the doctor how hard I've worked to be sober." And it was dead quiet. And then this guy, Craig, the junkie, said, "Jeff, I love you, man, but you haven't done a damn thing since you've been here. You know," he says, you've been really good at helping everyone else, but you haven't done a thing to help yourself." And so I reenlisted, and I stayed for a second month. And I started to listen, and I started to hear the message, but I was still doing it for all the wrong reasons. And I got out after 2 months, and I started going to meetings. But I still kept all my old friends, and I still hung out with all my old friends, and I still would go to parties. And I remember the very first party I went to, one of my best friends, John, you know, he pulled out, he had this big smile on his face. He came in with a case of beer and other liquor, and he reaches into the bag, and he pulls out a can of grape juice and gives me the grape juice. And, you know, he was trying to be nice, and I was, like, pissed off because I really didn't want the grape juice. You know, I wanted what was in the bag. And they kept leaving the room. And I noticed they were leaving, and finally I realized they were leaving to go get high and come back. And I said, "Look, I've been in treatment for 2 months. You guys don't need to leave. I'm fine now." And I'm sitting in the circle, like passing a joint, you know, and handing it to the next person, but not taking it. And that doesn't last long. So the next weekend I went out to a bar because I like live music, and I went with this friend of mine, Marla, and this girl could drink anyone in this room under a table, and she really missed her drinking buddy, and we're at this club listening to this band, and she ordered a drink, and I ordered a coffee, and I had 6 months sober. And I remember vividly ordering a coffee, and the waitress starts walking away, and I said, wait a minute, make that an Irish coffee. And I don't know where it came from, it just came out, and the waitress brought it, and I drank it, and it went down really smooth and felt good. And I remember thinking about you guys and thinking about the meetings and thinking about the treatment and thinking about my family and thinking about all the things I had been through. And so the only logical thing to do was to order a second one. So I ordered a second one, and I remember thinking, see, those guys really didn't know what they're talking about. I've had two, and I'm fine. And I stopped. And I stopped after two just to prove that I could stop after two. The book said I couldn't, you know, try some controlled drinking. And I stopped. After two, I was fine. And the problem was I took Marla home and I dropped her off. And somehow my car on the way home had a different idea than me. I was going home, but my car was going to the drug dealer's house. And I went back to that guy's house six times that night till he said, don't come back. And it took me a year and a half and another arrest before I made it back to these rooms. And the reason I share that is I would hear stories, and all these things that hadn't happened to me yet started to happen to me. And finally, on June 25th, 1984, I needed help, and I was desperate, and I couldn't stop. I was out of control. I didn't know what to do. I was totally flat broke. I had lost the business by this point. I had lost everything I owned. I was driving a car where I had worn out the brake pad, so it was just metal against metal. So every time you stop, it was this and I was trying to go to one of my best friend's houses. He had gotten married and had a couple kids by this time. And I said, he'll understand. We grew up together, and it was somebody I trusted. And I'd been to this house a million times, and for some reason, this particular night, I couldn't find the house. And I remember stopping at a stop sign, and I started to turn right, and then I remember it's left, and so I made this wide turn. And before that, I had been thinking as I was driving on the road that I would just end it. And my thought was I would get the car going as fast as I could, and I would just drive off a cliff. And I said, no, I need help. And I remember calling out three words. God help me. And I hear those words in the meetings all the time. And I said it, and I meant it for the first time in my life. And I said, God help me. And, you know, you hear about these bright light experiences. And mine wasn't a white light. It was more of a red and blue light. Sure enough, I got pulled over again. And this time, I'm trying to explain to the cop that I'm going for help. And I don't know what happened. Next thing I know, I am face down on the ground with this cop with his knee in my back, and all these other police cars come flying up with their shotguns out. And I remember laying in this cold, wet road with my face against the ground, and I look up, and there's people on a front porch just kind of looking, like shaking their heads. And I'm thinking, you know, they must just think that I'm just this horrible convict, you know. And I guess I was, you know, and I will swear on a stack of Bibles, but the arrest report, I got arrested again, and this time it was DUI, possession, because I always had things in my pocket, crossing a double yellow line, resisting arrest, and assault and battery on a cop. Now, the last two things I don't remember. And in their report, it says that I hit this cop three times. And I, to this day, swear that that didn't happen. But if it's in the report, it's in the report. What I also found out is most crimes have a limit of time, you know, like 3 to 5 years for robbery or for possession. Well, assault and battery on a peace officer can be life in jail. They could give you 99 years. And so I started to get scared. And they raised the bail. And I remember they had the handcuffs so tight that my hand was turning purple. And they had me chained to a wall. And I said, I need to make my phone call. And the guy said, what? And I said, I'm entitled to a phone call. He said, boy, you've been watching too much Perry Mason. And he threw the phone down, and I'm chained to the and he is 2 inches too far, and I'm trying to get to this stupid phone, and I didn't know who to call. And I finally get to the phone, and I call one of my cousins, and at 3 in the morning he comes out, and luckily he had some cash at home, and he was able to post the bond and get a bondsman. And we're in his car in the parking lot, and he's reading the arrest report, and he goes, "How could you do this?" And I said, "Do what?" And he says, "You hit the cop 3 times. Let me see that." You know, and I, to this day. So what happened was the next day I checked myself back into a hospital, went to a detox for 8 days, and then went back to a treatment. In the very first meeting at that treatment center, they used to bring meetings in, and the topic of the meeting, the guy shared, and the topic of the meeting was spirituality. And this guy spoke, and then he called on me to share. And I started to share my experience, and I said the reason I had failed the first time at recovery is I didn't have the spiritual part to this program. And the guy stopped me mid-sentence. He goes, "Wait a minute." He goes, "There is no spiritual part to this program. This is a spiritual program, and unless you get that, you're going to die." And I heard that. For some reason, I heard that, and I carried it with me. And I stopped at that point knowing the answers, and I started to listen. And they would say things like, "Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth," and I did. And I started to go to meetings every day. My first 2 years, I did not miss a meeting. I went to a meeting as if my life depended on it. I went every single day, some days 2 to 3 meetings. I had gotten to a point in my life where I had lost any ability to control on my own. You know, the ironic thing was that I was one of the last people out of my friends to party, you know, and here I am years later, and I couldn't stop. And so I started going to meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I started to work steps. And I remember I got a job, and I worked 6 days a week at this job for $50 a day, and it was in a record shop, a stereo and record store. And it was a guy that I met in recovery that was the manager of the store, and he said, "If you want, when you get out, I'll give you a job." And I worked 6 days a week at that job. I went to meetings every day. I started to participate, and what I found is a God of my understanding that has directed me and has led me in a way where my life is abundant. And I have a handful of sponsees here tonight. I have 26 years of recovery. I have a good life today. Now, my life is nothing like what I picture it should look like, but it's far better. And I remember when I got here, they said, "Hold on tight, because this is going to be the ride of your life." And it has been. And it has taken turns and directions that I never thought. And I have a couple minutes left. I'll share a story, and I don't share this so much because I'm proud, but I share it because through adversity, I think we become better. Through adversity and challenges and pain, I think we become stronger. And, you know, recovery isn't without challenges. It hasn't been, perfect from day one. My program today is stronger than it's been ever. I'm more active today than I've ever been, and I have been for a number of years. I've sponsored people for years and years. I have sponsees that have 25 years of recovery. I somehow, when I was 18, 19 years of recovery, I had some significant problems related to work. I ended up getting arrested as a result of that. And here I am with 19 years of sobriety. And the Fugitive Task Force came to my house at 6:30 in the morning and banging on the windows, calling my phone, calling my cell phone, and yanked me out of bed. I had no idea what was going on. And this is with 19 years of sobriety. And it really scared the heck out of me, and it again altered my life. And the following year, my brother got sick, my older brother, and he lived back east. I went home for a high school reunion and found out at that high school reunion or the day before that he had pancreatic cancer, the same cancer that my dad had. He was diagnosed in September. I was there in August. In August he was diagnosed. I came back in September. And I had amends to make to him, and I had held on to those amends for a lot of years. And my way of making amends was I moved in with him, and I took him to doctor's appointments, and I cared for him, and I did things that I never thought I'd have to do in my life. And December 16th of that year, he passed away, and I was with him when he passed away. And I walked him through that journey, and I know he was grateful. And I learned that he was a really cool guy. And it's too bad that it took years before I found that out. The following year, my mom died. 5 months later, my stepdad passed away. That same year, I was forced into bankruptcy. I lost my house. And I don't say these things out of sorrow or sadness, but what happened is because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of the friends I have, they were able to carry me through. And with the God of my understanding, I was directed. And I was responsible for making funeral arrangements for those funerals, and I spoke at those funerals. And I got cleared away the wreckage of my present with my court stuff. And the way that I worked that is I was able to make amends. And I said I didn't do anything knowingly, but if I'm wrong, I'll admit my part. And I made full restitution, and it took all the money that I had, including my house, but I made restitution so that no one was harmed, so I can feel okay with that today. And what that did is it got me back into action. It got me back into working steps. It got me back into sponsoring. And my life is better today because I appreciate every free moment. You know, when you have a fear like that and a fear of losing your freedom, you really realize how valuable freedom is. And I was locked in a jail in my addiction and my drinking for years. And Alcoholics Anonymous has set me free. And that same power of Alcoholics Anonymous and working the steps of recovery can set us free in all areas. And what I've learned is not just to bring God in to my drinking and my drinking and my using, I said drinking twice, but to bring God into all areas of my life and to ask for direction and guidance. And I start every morning the same way. I make my bed, I get on my knees, I say a third step prayer, I ask for direction. And today I also add that I may be of love and joy and service and to direct me. And it's not about me today. You know, when I go to a meeting, it's not about what I can get. It's about what I can give. And it has changed my life, and it's given meaning to my life, and it's giving depth and weight. You know, that the same way that I sought to alter my feelings through alcohol and drugs, I get that same feeling from working a program of recovery. And I'm honored to be here tonight. I'm blessed to be here. I thank you for taking time to listen to me.